proceeded to deliberate and vote. A just impulse of respect and gratitude prompted them to crown the virtues of the Doge. His wisdom had inspired their enterprise, and the most youthful knights might envy and applaud the exploits of blindness and age. But the patriot Dandolo was devoid of all personal ambition and fully satisfied that he had been judged worthy to reign. His nomination was overruled by the Venetians themselves. His countrymen, and perhaps his friends, represented, with the eloquence of truth, the mischiefs that might arise to national freedom and the common cause from the union of two incompatible characters, of the first magistrate of a republic and the emperor of the East. The exclusion of the Doge left room for the more equal merits of Boniface and Baldwin, and at their names all meaner candidates respectfully withdrew. The Marquis of Montferrat was recommended by his mature age and fair reputation, by the choice of the adventurers and the wishes of the Greeks. Nor can I believe that Venice, the mistress of the sea, could be seriously apprehensive of a petty lord at the foot of the Alps. But the Count of Flanders was the chief of a wealthy and warlike people. He was valiant, pious, and chaste. In the prime of life, since he was only 32 years of age, a descendant of Charlemagne, a cousin of the King of France, and a compeer of the prelates and barons who had yielded with reluctance to the command of a foreigner. Without the chapel, these barons, with the Doge and Marquis at their head, expected the decision of the 12 electors. It was announced by the Bishop of Soissons in the name of his colleagues. "Ye have sworn to obey the prince whom we should choose. By our unanimous suffrage, Baldwin, Count of Flanders, and Hainaut, is now your sovereign and the Emperor of the East." He was saluted with loud applause, and the proclamation was re-echoed through the city by the joy of the Latins and the trembling adulation of the Greeks. Boniface was the first to kiss the hand of his rival and to raise him on the buckler, and Baldwin was transported to the cathedral and solemnly invested with the purple buskins. At the end of 3 weeks he was crowned by the legate in the vacancy of the patriarch. But the Venetian clergy soon filled the chapter of Santa Sophia, seated Thomas Morosini on the ecclesiastical throne, and employed every art to perpetrate in their own nation the honours and benefices of the Greek Church. Without delay the successor of Constantine instructed Palestine, France, and Rome of this memorable revolution. To Palestine he sent, as a trophy, the gates of Constantinople and the chain of the harbour, and adopted, from the assizes of Jerusalem, the laws or customs best adapted to a French colony and conquest in the East. In his epistles, the natives of France are encouraged to swell that colony and to secure that conquest, to people a magnificent city and a fertile land which will reward the labors both of the priest and the soldier. He congratulates the Roman pontiff on the restoration of his authority in the East, invites him to extinguish the Greek schism by his presence in a general council, and implores his blessing and forgiveness for the disobedient pilgrims. Prudence and dignity are blended in the answer of Innocent. In the subversion of the Byzantine Empire, he arraigns the vices of man and adores the providence of God. The conquerors will be absolved or condemned by their future conduct. The validity of their treaty depends on the judgment of St. Peter, but he inculcates their most sacred duty of establishing a just subordination of obedience and tribute from the Greeks to the Latins, from the magistrate to the clergy, and from the clergy to the Pope. In the division of the Greek provinces, the share of the Venetians was more ample than that of the Latin emperor. No more than one-fourth was appropriated to his domain. A clear moiety of the remainder was reserved for Venice, and the other moiety was distributed among the adventurers of France and Lombardy. The venerable Dandolo was proclaimed despot of Romania, and invested, after the Greek fashion, with the purple buskins. He ended at Constantinople his long and glorious life, and if the prerogative was personal, the title was used by his successors till the middle of the 14th century, with the singular, though true, addition of lords of one-fourth and a half of the Roman Empire. The Doge, a slave of state, was seldom permitted to depart from the helm of the Republic, but his place was supplied by the Bail, or Regent, who exercised a supreme jurisdiction over the colony of Venetians. They possessed three of the eight quarters of the city, and his independent tribunal was composed of six judges, four councillors, two chamberlains, two fiscal advocates, and a constable. Their long experience of the Eastern trade enabled them to select their portion with discernment. They had rashly accepted the dominion and defense of Adrianople, but it was the more reasonable aim of their policy to form a chain of factories and cities and islands along the maritime coast from the neighborhood of Ragusa to the Hellespont and the Bosphorus. The labor and cost of such extensive conquests exhausted their treasury. They abandoned their maxims of government, adopted a feudal system, and contented themselves with the homage of their nobles. For the possessions which these private vassals undertook to reduce and maintain. And thus it was that the family of Sanud acquired the duchy of Naxos, which involved the greatest part of the archipelago. For the price of 10,000 marks, the Republic purchased of the Marquis of Montferrat the fertile island of Crete, or Candia, with the ruins of 100 cities. But its improvement was stented by the proud and narrow spirit of an aristocracy, and the wisest senators would confess that the sea, not the land, was the treasury of St. Mark. In the moiety of the adventurers, the Marquis Boniface might claim the most liberal reward, and besides the Isle of Crete, his exclusion from the throne was compensated by the royal title and the provinces beyond the Hellespont. But he prudently exchanged that distant and difficult conquest for the kingdom of Thessalonica, Macedonia, 12 days' journey from the capital, where he might be supported by the neighboring powers of his brother-in-law, the king of Hungary. His progress was hailed by the voluntary or reluctant acclamations of the natives, and Greece, the proper and ancient Greece, again received a Latin conqueror, who trod with indifference that classic ground. He viewed with a careless eye the beauties of the Valley of Tempe, traversed with a cautious step the Straits of Thermopylae, occupied the unknown cities of Thebes, Athens, and Argos, and assaulted the fortifications of Corinth and Napoli, which resisted his arms. The lots of the Latin pilgrims were regulated by chance, or choice, or subsequent exchange, and they abused with intemperate joy their triumph over the lives and fortunes of a great people. After a minute survey of the provinces, they weighed in the scales of avarice, the revenue of each district, the advantage of the situation, and the ample or scanty supplies for the maintenance of soldiers and horses. Their presumption claimed and divided the long-lost dependencies of the Roman scepter. The Nile and Euphrates rolled through their imaginary realms, and happy was the warrior who drew for his prize the palace of the Turkish Sultan of Iconium. I shall not descend to the pedigree of families and the rent-roll of estates, but I wish to specify that the Counts of Blois and St. Pol were invested with the Duchy of Nice and the Lordship of Demotica. The principal fiefs were held by the service of constable, chamberlain, cupbearer, butler, and chief cook. And our historian, Geoffrey of Villehardouin, obtained a fair establishment on the banks of the Hebrus, and united the double office of Marshal of Champagne and Romania. At the head of his knights and archers, each baron mounted on horseback to secure the possession of his share, and their first efforts were generally successful. But the public force was weakened by their dispersion, and 1,000 quarrels must arise under a law and among men whose sole empire was the sword. Within 3 months after the conquest of Constantinople, the emperor and the king of Thessalonica drew their hostile followers into the field. They were reconciled by the authority of the Doge, the advice of the marshal, and the firm freedom of their peers. Two fugitives who had reigned at Constantinople still asserted the title of emperor, and the subjects of their fallen throne might be moved to pity by the misfortunes of the elder Alexius, or excited to revenge by the spirit of Muzufla. A domestic alliance, a common interest, a similar guilt, and the merit of extinguishing his enemies, a brother and a nephew, induced the more recent usurper to unite with the former the relics of his power. Muzufla was received with smiles and honors in the camp of his father Alexius. But the wicked can never love and should rarely trust their fellow criminals. He was seized in the bath, deprived of his eyes, stripped of his troops and treasures, and turned out to wander an object of horror and contempt to those who with more propriety could hate, and with more justice could punish the assassin of the Emperor Isaac and his son. As the tyrant, pursued by fear or remorse, was stealing over to Asia, he was seized by the Latins of Constantinople and condemned, after an open trial, to an ignominious death. His judges debated the mode of his execution, the axe, the wheel, or the stake, and it was resolved that Muzufla should ascend the Theodosian Column, a pillar of white marble of 147 feet in height. From the summit he was cast down headlong and dashed in pieces on the pavement, in the presence of innumerable spectators who filled the Forum of Taurus and admired the accomplishment of an old prediction which was explained by this singular event. The fate of Alexius is less tragical. He was sent by the Marquis a captive to Italy and a gift to the King of the Romans. But he had not much to applaud his fortune if the sentence of imprisonment and exile were changed from a fortress in the Alps to a monastery in Asia. But his daughter, before the national calamity, had been given in marriage to a young hero who continued the succession and restored the throne of the Greek princes. The valor of Theodore Lascaris was signalized in the two sieges of Constantinople. After the flight of Muzufla, when the Latins were already in the city, he offered himself as their emperor to the soldiers and people, and his ambition, which might be virtuous, was undoubtedly brave. Could he have infused a soul into the multitude, they might have crushed the strangers under their feet. Their abject despair refused his aid, and Theodore retired to breathe the air of freedom in Anatolia, beyond the immediate view and pursuit of the conquerors. Under the title, at first of despot, and afterwards of emperor, he drew to his standard the bolder spirits who were fortified against slavery by the contempt of life, and, as every means was lawful for the public safety, implored without scruple the alliance of the Turkish Sultan. Nice, where Theodore established his residence, Prusa and Philadelphia, Smyrna and Ephesus, opened their gates to their deliverer. He derived strength and reputation from his victories and even from his defeats, and the successor of Constantine preserved a fragment of the empire from the banks of the Meander to the suburbs of Nicomedia, and at length of Constantinople. Another portion, distant and obscure, was possessed by the lineal heir of the Comneni, a son of the virtuous Manuel, the grandson of the tyrant Andronicus. His name was Alexius, and the epithet of great was applied perhaps to his stature rather than to his exploits. By the indulgence of the Angeli, he was appointed governor or duke of Trebizond. His birth gave him ambition, the revolution, independence, and without changing his title, he reigned in peace from Sinope to the Phasis along the coast of the Black Sea. His nameless son and successor is described as the vassal of the Sultan, whom he served with 200 lances. That Comnenian prince was no more than Duke of Trebizond, and the title of emperor was first assumed by the pride and envy of the grandson of Alexius. In the west, a third fragment was saved from the common shipwreck by Michael, a bastard of the House of Angeli, who before the revolution had been known as a hostage, a soldier, and a rebel. His flight from the camp of the Marquis Boniface secured his freedom. By his marriage with the governor's daughter, he commanded the important place of Durazzo, assumed the title of despot, and founded a strong and conspicuous principality in Epirus, Aetolia, and Thessaly, which have ever been peopled by a warlike race. The Greeks who had offered their service to their new sovereigns were excluded by the haughty Latins from all civil and military honors as a nation born to tremble and obey. Their resentment prompted them to show that they might have been useful friends, since they could be dangerous enemies. Their nerves were braced by adversity. Whatever was learned or holy, whatever was noble or valiant, rolled away into the independent states of Trebizond, Epirus, and Nice. And a single patrician is marked by the ambiguous praise of attachment and loyalty to the Franks. The vulgar herd of the cities and the country would have gladly submitted to a mild and regular servitude. Then the transient disorders of war would have been obliterated by some years of industry and peace. But peace was banished, and industry was crushed in the disorders of the feudal system. The Roman emperors of Constantinople, if they were endowed with abilities, were armed with power for the protection of their subjects. Their laws were wise, and their administration was simple. The Latin throne was filled by a titular prince, the chief, and often the servant of his licentious confederates. The fiefs of the empire, from a kingdom to a castle, were held and ruled by the sword of the barons, and their discord, poverty, and ignorance extended the ramifications of tyranny to the most sequestered villages. The Greeks were oppressed by the double weight of the priest, who was invested with temporal power, and of the soldier, who was inflamed by fanatic hatred. And the inseparable bar of religion and language forever separated the stranger and the native. As long as the Crusaders were united at Constantinople, the memory of their conquest and the terror of their arms imposed silence on the captive land. Their dispersion betrayed the smallness of their numbers and the defects of their discipline, and some failures and mischances revealed the secret that they were not invincible. As the fears of the Greeks abated, their hatred increased. They murdered, they conspired, and before a year of slavery had elapsed, they implored or accepted the succor of a barbarian whose power they had felt and whose gratitude they trusted. The Latin conquerors had been saluted with a solemn and early embassy from John, or Joannis, or Calo John, the revolted chief of the Bulgarians and Wallachians. He deemed himself their brother, as the votary of the Roman pontiff, from whom he had received the regal title and a holy banner, and in the subversion of the Greek monarchy he might aspire to the name of their friend and accomplice. But Calo John was astonished to find that the Count of Flanders had assumed the pomp and pride of the successors of Constantine, and his ambassadors were dismissed with a haughty message that the rebel must deserve a pardon by touching with his forehead the footstool of the imperial throne. His resentment would have exhaled in acts of violence and blood. His cooler policy watched the rising discontent of the Greeks, affected a tender concern for their sufferings, and promised that their first struggles for freedom should be supported by his person and kingdom. The conspiracy was propagated by national hatred, the firmest band of association and secrecy. The Greeks were impatient to sheathe their daggers in the breasts of the victorious strangers, but the execution was prudently delayed till Henry, the emperor's brother, had transported the flower of his troops beyond the Hellespont. Most of the towns and villages of Thrace were true to the moment and the signal, and the Latins, without arms or suspicion, were slaughtered by the vile and merciless revenge of their slaves. From Demotica, the first scene of the massacre, the surviving vassals of the Count of St. Paul escaped to Adrianople, but the French and Venetians who occupied that city were slain or expelled by the furious multitude. The garrisons that could effect their retreat fell back on each other towards the metropolis, and the fortresses that separately stood against the rebels were ignorant of each other's and of their sovereign's fate. The voice of fame and fear announced the revolt of the Greeks and the rapid approach of their Bulgarian ally. And Calo John, not depending on the forces of his own kingdom, had drawn from the Scythian wilderness a body of 14,000 Comans, who drank, as it was said, the blood of their captives, and sacrificed the Christians on the altars of their gods. Alarmed by this sudden and growing danger, the emperor dispatched a swift messenger to recall Count Henry and his troops, and had Baldwin expected the return of his gallant brother with a supply of 20,000 Armenians, he might have encountered the invader with equal numbers and a decisive superiority of arms and discipline. But the spirit of chivalry could seldom discriminate caution from cowardice, and the emperor took the field with 140 knights and their train of archers and sergeants. The marshal, who dissuaded and obeyed, led the vanguard in their march to Adrianople. The main body was commanded by the Count of Blois. The aged Doge of Venice followed with the rear, and their scanty numbers were increased from all sides by the fugitive Latins. They undertook to besiege the rebels of Adrianople, and such was the pious tendency of the Crusades that they employed the Holy Week in pillaging the country for their subsistence, and in framing engines for the destruction of their fellow Christians. But the Latins were soon interrupted and alarmed by the light cavalry of the Comans, who boldly skirmished to the edge of their imperfect lines, and a proclamation was issued by the Marshal of Romania that on the trumpet's sound the cavalry should mount and form, but that none, under pain of death, should abandon themselves to a desultory and dangerous pursuit. This wise injunction was first disobeyed by the Count of Blois, who involved the emperor in his rashness and ruin. The Comans, of the Parthian or Tartar school, fled before their first charge, but after a career of 2 leagues, when the knights and their horses were almost breathless, they suddenly turned, rallied, and encompassed the heavy squadrons of the Franks. The count was slain on the field, the emperor was made prisoner, and if the one disdained to fly, if the other refused to yield, their personal bravery made a poor atonement for their ignorance or neglect of the duties of a general. Proud of his victory and his royal prize, the Bulgarian advanced to relieve Adrianople and achieve the destruction of the Latins. They must have inevitably been destroyed if the Marshal of Romania had not displayed a cool courage and consummate skill, uncommon in all ages, but most uncommon in those times, when war was a passion rather than a science. His grief and fears were poured into the firm and faithful bosom of the Doge, but in the camp he diffused an assurance of safety which could only be realized by the general belief. All day he maintained his perilous station between the city and the barbarians. Via Hardouin decamped in silence at the dead of night, and his masterly retreat of 3 days would have deserved the praise of Xenophon and the 10,000. In the rear, the marshal supported the weight of the pursuit. In the front, he moderated the impatience of the fugitives, and wherever the Comans approached, they were repelled by a line of impenetrable spears. On the third day, the weary troops beheld the sea, the solitary town of Rodosta, and their friends, who had landed from the Asiatic shore. They embraced, they wept, but they united their arms and counsels, and in his brother's absence, Count Henry assumed the regency of the empire, at once in a state of childhood and caducity. If the Comans withdrew from the summer heats, 7,000 Latins, in the hour of danger, deserted Constantinople, their brethren, and their vows. Some partial success was overbalanced by the loss of 120 knights in the field of Rusium, and of the imperial domain, no more was left than the capital, with two or three adjacent fortresses on the shores of Europe and Asia. The king of Bulgaria was resistless and inexorable, and Calo John respectfully eluded the demands of the Pope, who conjured his new proselyte to restore peace and the emperor to the afflicted Latins. The deliverance of Baldwin was no longer, he said, in the power of man. That prince had died in prison, and the manner of his death is variously related by ignorance and credulity. The lovers of a tragic legend will be pleased to hear that the royal captive was tempted by the amorous queen of the Bulgarians, that his chaste refusal exposed him to the falsehood of a woman and the jealousy of a savage, that his hands and feet were severed from his body, that his bleeding trunk was cast among the carcasses of dogs and horses, and that he breathed 3 days before he was devoured by the birds of prey. About 20 years afterwards, in a wood of the Netherlands, a hermit announced himself as the true Baldwin, the emperor of Constantinople, and lawful sovereign of Flanders. He related the wonders of his escape, his adventures, and his penance among a people prone to believe and to rebel. And in the first transport, Flanders acknowledged her long-lost sovereign. A short examination before the French court detected the impostor, who was punished with an ignominious death. But the Flemings still adhered to the pleasing error, and the Countess Jane is accused by the gravest historians of sacrificing to her ambition the life of an unfortunate father. In all civilized hostility, a treaty is established for the exchange or ransom of prisoners, and if their captivity be prolonged, their condition is known, and they are treated according to their rank, with humanity or honor. But the savage Bulgarian was a stranger to the laws of war. His prisons were involved in darkness and silence, and above a year elapsed before the Latins could be assured of the death of Baldwin, before his brother, the regent, Henry, would consent to assume the title of emperor. His moderation was applauded by the Greeks as an act of rare and inimitable virtue. Their light and perfidious ambition was eager to seize or anticipate the moment of a vacancy, while a law of succession, the guardian both of the prince and people, was gradually defined and confirmed in the hereditary monarchies of Europe. In the support of the Eastern Empire, Henry was gradually left without an associate, as the heroes of the Crusade retired from the world or from the war. The Doge of Venice, the venerable Dandolo, in the fullness of years and glory, sunk into the grave. The Marquis of Montferrat was slowly recalled from the Peloponnesian War to the revenge of Baldwin and the defense of Thessalonica. Some nice disputes of feudal homage and service were reconciled in a personal interview between the emperor and the king. They were firmly united by mutual esteem and the common danger, and their allegiance was sealed by the nuptials of Henry with the daughter of the Italian prince. He soon deplored the loss of his friend and father. At the persuasion of some faithful Greeks, Boniface made a bold and successful inroad among the hills of Rhodope. The Bulgarians fled on his approach. They assembled to harass his retreat. On the intelligence that his rear was attacked, without waiting for any defensive armor, he leapt on horseback, couched his lance, and drove the enemies before him. But in the rash pursuit he was pierced with a mortal wound, and the head of the king of Thessalonica was presented to Calo John, who enjoyed the honors without the merit of victory. It is here, at this melancholy event, that the pen or the voice of Geoffrey of Villehardouin seems to drop or to expire, and if he still exercised his military office of Marshal of Romania, his subsequent exploits are buried in oblivion. The character of Henry was not unequal to his arduous situation. In the siege of Constantinople and beyond the Hellespont, he had deserved the fame of a valiant knight and a skilful commander, and his courage was tempered with a degree of prudence and mildness unknown to his impetuous brother. In the double war against the Greeks of Asia and the Bulgarians of Europe, he was ever the foremost on shipboard or on horseback, and though he cautiously provided for the success of his arms, the drooping Latins were often roused by his example to save and to second their fearless emperor. But such efforts and some supplies of men and money from France were of less avail than the errors, the cruelty, and death of their most formidable adversary. When the despair of the Greek subjects invited Caleb John as their deliverer, they hoped that he would protect their liberty and adopt their laws. They were soon taught to compare the degrees of national ferocity and to execrate the savage conqueror who no longer dissembled his intention of dispeopling Thrace, of demolishing the cities, and of transplanting the inhabitants beyond the Danube. Many towns and villages of Thrace were already evacuated. A heap of ruins marked the place of Philippopolis, and a similar calamity was expected at Demotica and Adrianople by the first authors of the revolt. They raised a cry of grief and repentance to the throne of Henry. The emperor alone had the magnanimity to forgive and trust them. No more than 400 knights, with their sergeants and archers, could be assembled under his banner, and with this slender force he fought and repulsed the Bulgarian, who, besides his infantry, was at the head of 40,000 horse. In this expedition, Henry felt the difference between a hostile and a friendly country. The remaining cities were preserved by his arms, and the savage, with shame and loss, was compelled to relinquish his prey. The siege of Thessalonica was the last of the evils which Caleb John inflicted or suffered. He was stabbed in the night in his tent, and the general, perhaps the assassin, who found him weltering in his blood, ascribed the blow with general applause to the lance of St. Demetrius. After several victories, the prudence of Henry concluded an honorable peace with the successor of the tyrant, and with the Greek princes of Nice and Epirus. If he ceded some doubtful limits, an ample kingdom was reserved for himself and his feudatories, and his reign, which lasted only 10 years, afforded a short interval of prosperity and peace. Far above the narrow policy of Baldwin and Boniface, he freely entrusted to the Greeks the most important offices of the state and army, and this liberality of sentiment and practice was the more seasonable, as the princes of Nice and Epirus had already learned to seduce and employ the mercenary valour of the Latins. It was the aim of Henry to unite and reward his deserving subjects of every nation and language. But he appeared less solicitous to accomplish the impracticable union of the two churches. Pelagius, the Pope's legate, who acted as the sovereign of Constantinople, had interdicted the worship of the Greeks and sternly imposed the payment of tithes, the double procession of the Holy Ghost, and a blind obedience to the Roman pontiff. As the weaker party, they pleaded the duties of conscience and implored the rights of toleration. "Our bodies," they said, "are Caesar's, but our souls belong only to God." The persecution was checked by the firmness of the emperor, and if we can believe that the same prince was poisoned by the Greeks themselves, we must entertain a contemptible idea of the sense and gratitude of mankind. His valour was a vulgar attribute which he shared with 10,000 knights, but Henry possessed the superior courage to oppose in a superstitious age the pride and avarice of the clergy. In the Cathedral of Santa Sophia, he presumed to place his throne on the right hand of the Patriarch, and this presumption excited the sharpest censure of Pope Innocent III. By salutary edict, one of the first examples of the laws of mortmain, he prohibited the alienation of fiefs. Many of the Latins, desirous of returning to Europe, resigned their estates to the Church for a spiritual or temporal reward. These holy lands were immediately discharged from military service, and a colony of soldiers would have been gradually transformed into a college of priests. The virtuous Henry died at Thessalonica in the defense of that kingdom, and of an infant, the son of his friend Boniface. In the two first emperors of Constantinople, the male line of the Counts of Flanders was extinct. But their sister, Yolanda, was the wife of a French prince, the mother of a numerous progeny, and one of her daughters had married Andrew, King of Hungary, a brave and pious champion of the cross. By seating him on the Byzantine throne, the barons of Romania would have acquired the forces of a neighboring and warlike kingdom. But the prudent Andrew revered the laws of succession, and the princess Yolanda, with her husband Peter of Courtenay, Count of Auxerre, was invited by the Latins to assume the empire of the East. The royal birth of his father, the noble origin of his mother, recommended to the barons of France the first cousin of their king. His reputation was fair, his possessions were ample, and in the bloody crusade against the Albigeois, the troops and the priests had been abundantly satisfied of his zeal and valor. Vanity might applaud the elevation of a French emperor of Constantinople, but prudence must pity rather than envy his treacherous and imaginary greatness. To assert and adorn his title, he was reduced to sell or mortgage the best of his patrimony. But these expedients, the liberality of his royal kinsman Philip Augustus, and the national spirit of chivalry, he was enabled to pass the Alps at the head of 140 knights and 5,500 sergeants and archers. After some hesitation, Pope Honorius III was persuaded to crown the successor of Constantine. But he performed the ceremony in a church without the walls, lest he should seem to imply or to bestow any right of sovereignty over the ancient capital of the empire. The Venetians had engaged to transport Peter and his forces beyond the Adriatic, and the Empress with her four children to the Byzantine palace. But they required, as the price of their service, that he should recover Durazzo from the despot of Epirus. Michael Angelus, or Comnenus, the first of his dynasty, had bequeathed the succession of his power and ambition to Theodore, his legitimate brother, who already threatened and invaded the establishments of the Latins. After discharging his debt by fruitless assault, the emperor raised the siege to prosecute a long and perilous journey overland from Durazzo to Thessalonica. He was soon lost in the mountains of Epirus. The passes were fortified. His provisions exhausted. He was delayed and deceived by treacherous negotiation. And after Peter of Courtenay and the Roman legate had been arrested in a banquet, the French troops, without leaders or hopes, were eager to exchange their arms for the delusive promise of mercy and bread. The Vatican thundered, and the impious Theodore was threatened with the vengeance of earth and heaven. But the captive emperor and his soldiers were forgotten, and the reproaches of the Pope are confined to the imprisonment of his legate. No sooner was he satisfied by the deliverance of the priests and a promise of spiritual obedience than he pardoned and protected the despot of Epirus. His peremptory commands suspended the ardor of the Venetians and the King of Hungary, and it was only by natural or untimely death that Peter of Courtenay was released from his hopeless captivity. The long ignorance of his fate and the presence of the lawful sovereign, of Yolanda, his wife or widow, delayed the proclamation of a new emperor. Before her death, and in the midst of her grief, she was delivered of a son who was named Baldwin, the last and most unfortunate of the Latin princes of Constantinople. His birth endeared him to the barons of Romania, but his childhood would have prolonged the troubles of a minority, and his claims were superseded by the elder claims of his brethren. The first of these, Philip of Courtenay, who derived from his mother the inheritance of Namur, had the wisdom to prefer the substance of a marquisate to the shadow of an empire. And on his refusal, Robert, the second of the sons of Peter and Yolanda, was called to the throne of Constantinople. Warned by his father's mischance, he pursued his slow and secure journey through Germany and along the Danube. A passage was opened by his sister's marriage with the King of Hungary, and the Emperor Robert was crowned by the Patriarch in the Cathedral of Santa Sophia. But his reign was an era of calamity and disgrace, and the colony, as it was styled, of New France, yielded on all sides to the Greeks of Nice and Epirus. After a victory which he owed to his perfidy rather than his courage, Theodore Angelus entered the kingdom of Thessalonica, expelled the feeble Demetrius, the son of the Marquis Boniface, erected his standard on the walls of Adrianople, and added, by his vanity, a third or a fourth name to the list of rival emperors. The relics of the Asiatic province were swept away by John Vatakis, the son-in-law and successor of Theodore Lascaris, and who, in a triumphant reign of 33 years, displayed the virtues both of peace and war. Under his discipline, the swords of the French mercenaries were the most effectual instruments of his conquests, and their desertion from the service of their country was at once a symptom and a cause of the rising ascendant of the Greeks. By the construction of a fleet, he obtained the command of the Hellespont, reduced the islands of Lesbos and Rhodes, attacked the Venetians of Candia, and intercepted the rare and parsimonious successes of the West. Once, and once only, the Latin emperor sent an army against Vatakis, and in the defeat of that army, the veteran knights, the last of the original conquerors, were left on the field of battle. But the success of a foreign enemy was less painful to the pusillanimous Robert than the insolence of his Latin subjects, who confounded the weakness of the emperor and of the empire. His personal misfortunes will prove the anarchy of the government and the ferociousness of the times. The amorous youth had neglected his Greek bride, the daughter of Vatakis, to introduce into the palace a beautiful maid of a private, though noble, family of Artois. And her mother had been tempted by the lustre of the purple to forfeit her engagements with a gentleman of Burgundy. His love was converted into rage. He assembled his friends, forced the palace gates, threw the mother into the sea, and inhumanly cut off the nose and lips of the wife or concubine of the emperor. Instead of punishing the offender, the barons avowed and applauded the savage deed, which, as a prince and as a man, it was impossible that Robert should forgive. He escaped from the guilty city to implore the justice or compassion of the Pope. The emperor was coolly exhorted to return to his station. Before he could obey, he sunk under the weight of grief, shame, and impotent resentment. It was only in the age of chivalry that valor could ascend from a private situation to the thrones of Jerusalem and Constantinople. The titular kingdom of Jerusalem had devolved to Mary, the daughter of Isabella and Conrad of Montferrat, and the granddaughter of Almeric or Amaury. She was given to John of Brienne, of a noble family in Champagne, by the public voice and the judgment of Philip Augustus, who named him as the most worthy champion of the Holy Land. In the Fifth Crusade he led 100,000 Latins to the conquest of Egypt. By him the siege of Damietta was achieved, and the subsequent failure was justly ascribed to the pride and avarice of the legate. After the marriage of his daughter with Frederick II, he was provoked by the emperor's ingratitude to accept the command of the army of the Church. And though advanced in life and despoiled of royalty, the sword and spirit of John of Brienne were still ready for the service of Christendom. In the 7 years of his brother's reign, Baldwin of Courtenay had not emerged from a state of childhood, and the barons of Romania felt the strong necessity of placing the scepter in the hands of a man and a hero. The veteran king of Jerusalem might have disdained the name and office of regent. They agreed to invest him for his life with the title and prerogatives of emperor, on the sole condition that Baldwin should marry his second daughter, and succeed at a mature age to the throne of Constantinople. The expectation, both of the Greeks and Latins, was kindled by the renown, the choice, and the presence of John of Brienne, and they admired his martial aspect, his green and vigorous age of more than 80 years, and his size and stature, which surpassed the common measure of mankind. But avarice and the love of ease appear to have chilled the ardor of enterprise. His troops were disbanded, and 2 years rolled away without action or honor, till he was awakened by the dangerous alliance of Vataces, emperor of Nice, and of Azan, king of Bulgaria. They besieged Constantinople by sea and land, with an army of 100,000 men and a fleet of 300 ships of war, while the entire force of the Latin emperor was reduced to 160 knights and a small addition of sergeants and archers. I tremble to relate that instead of defending the city, the hero made a sally at the head of his cavalry, and that of 48 squadrons of the enemy, no more than 3 escaped from the edge of his invincible sword. Fired by his example, the infantry and the citizens boarded the vessels that anchored close to the walls, and 25 were dragged in triumph into the harbor of Constantinople. At the summons of the emperor, the vassals and his allies, armed in her defense, broke through every obstacle that opposed their passage, and in the succeeding year obtained a second victory over the same enemies. By the rude poets of the age, John of Brienne is compared to Hector, Roland, and Judas Maccabeus. But their credit and his glory receive some abatement from the silence of the Greeks. The empire was soon deprived of the last of her champions, and the dying monarch was ambitious to enter paradise in the habit of a Franciscan friar. In the double victory of John of Brienne, I cannot discover the name or exploits of his pupil Baldwin, who had attained the age of military service and who succeeded to the imperial dignity on the decease of his adoptive father. The royal youth was employed on a commission more suitable to his temper. He was sent to visit the western courts, of the Pope more especially, and of the King of France, to excite their pity by the view of his innocence and distress, and to obtain some supplies of men or money for the relief of the sinking empire. He thrice repeated these mendicant visits, in which he seemed to prolong his stay and postpone his return. Of the 25 years of his reign, a greater number were spent abroad than at home, and in no place did the emperor deem himself less free and secure than in his native country and his capital. On some public occasions his vanity might be soothed by the title of Augustus, and by the honors of the purple, and at the general council of Lyon, when Frederick II was excommunicated and deposed, his oriental colleague was enthroned on the right hand of the Pope. But how often was the exile, the vagrant, the imperial beggar, humbled with scorn, insulted with pity, and degraded in his own eyes and those of the nations. In his first visit to England he was stopped at Dover by severe reprimand that he should presume without leave to enter an independent kingdom. After some delay, Baldwin, however, was permitted to pursue his journey, was entertained with cold civility, and thankfully departed with a present of 700 marks. From the avarice of Rome he could only obtain the proclamation of a crusade and a treasure of indulgences, a coin whose currency was depreciated by too frequent and indiscriminate abuse. His birth and misfortunes recommended him to the generosity of his cousin Louis the Ninth, but the martial zeal of the saints was diverted from Constantinople to Egypt and Palestine, and the public and private property of Baldwin was alleviated, for a moment, by the alienation of the Marquisat of Namur and the Lordship of Courtenay, the last remains of his inheritance. By such shameful or ruinous expedients, he once more returned to Romania with an army of 30,000 soldiers, whose numbers were doubled in the apprehension of the Greeks. His first dispatches to France and England announced his victories and his hopes. He had reduced the country round the capital to the distance of 3 days' journey, and if he succeeded against an important, though nameless, city, most probably Chioli, the frontier would be safe and the passage accessible. But these expectations, if Baldwin was sincere, quickly vanished like a dream. The troops and treasures of France melted away in his unskillful hands, and the throne of the Latin emperor was protected by a dishonorable alliance with the Turks and Comans. To secure the former, he consented to bestow his niece on the unbelieving Sultan of Cogni. To please the latter, he complied with their pagan rites. A dog was sacrificed between the two armies, and the contracting parties tasted each other's blood as a pledge of their fidelity. In the palace, or prison, of Constantinople, the successor of Augustus demolished the vacant houses for winter fuel, and stripped the lead from the churches for the daily expense of his family. Some usurious loans were dealt with a scanty hand by the merchants of Italy, and Philip, his son and heir, was pawned at Venice as the security for a debt. Thirst, hunger, and nakedness are positive evils, but wealth is relative, and a prince who would be rich in a private station may be exposed by the increase of his wants to all the anxiety and bitterness of poverty. But in this abject distress, the emperor and empire were still possessed of an ideal treasure, which drew its fantastic value from the superstition of the Christian world. The merit of the true cross was somewhat impaired by its frequent division, and a long captivity among the infidels might shed some suspicion on the fragments that were produced in the East and West. But another relic of the Passion was preserved in the imperial chapel of Constantinople, and the crown of thorns which had been placed on the head of Christ was equally precious and authentic. It had formerly been the practice of the Egyptian debtors to deposit as a security the mummies of their parents, and both their honour and religion were bound for the redemption of the pledge. In the same manner, and in the absence of the emperor, the barons of Romania borrowed the sum of 13,134 pieces of gold on the credit of the Holy Crown. They failed in the performance of their contract, and a rich Venetian, Nicholas Querini, undertook to satisfy their impatient creditors on condition that the relic should be lodged at Venice to become his absolute property if it were not redeemed within a short and definite term. The barons apprised their sovereign of the hard treaty and impending loss, and as the empire could not afford a ransom of 7,000 pounds sterling, Baldwin was anxious to snatch the prize from the Venetians, and to vest it with more honour and emolument in the hands of the most Christian king. Yet the negotiation was attended with some delicacy. In the purchase of relics, the saint would have started at the guilt of simony. But if the mode of expression were changed, he might lawfully repay the debt, accept the gift, and acknowledge the obligation. His ambassadors, two Dominicans, were dispatched to Venice to redeem and receive the Holy Crown which had escaped the dangers of the sea and the galleys of Vataces. On opening a wooden box, they recognized the seals of the Doge and Barons, which were applied on a shrine of silver, and within this shrine the monument of the Passion was enclosed in a golden vase. The reluctant Venetians yielded to justice and power. The Emperor Frederick granted a free and honorable passage. The court of France advanced as far as Troyes in Champagne to meet with devotion this inestimable relic. It was borne in triumph through Paris by the king himself, barefoot and in his shirt, and a free gift of 10,000 marks of silver reconciled Baldwin to his loss. The success of this transaction tempted the Latin emperor to offer, with the same generosity, the remaining furniture of his chapel, a large and authentic portion of the true cross, the baby linen of the Son of God, the lance, the sponge, and the chain of his Passion, the rod of Moses, and part of the skull of St. John the Baptist. For the reception of these spiritual treasures, 20,000 marks were expended by St. Louis on a stately foundation, the Holy Chapel of Paris, on which the muse of Beaulieu has bestowed a comic immortality. The truth of such remote and ancient relics, which cannot be proved by any human testimony, must be admitted by those who believe in the miracles which they have performed. About the middle of the last age, an inveterate ulcer was touched and cured by a holy prickle of the Holy Crown. The prodigy is attested by the most pious and enlightened Christians of France, nor will the fact be easily disproved, except by those who are armed with a general antidote against religious credulity. The Latins of Constantinople were on all sides encompassed and pressed. Their sole hope, the last delay of their ruin, was in the division of their Greek and Bulgarian enemies, and of this hope they were deprived by the superior arms and policy of Vataces, Emperor of Nice. From the Propontis to the rocky coast of Pamphylia, Asia was peaceful and prosperous under his reign, and the events of every campaign extended his influence in Europe. The strong cities of the hills of Macedonia and Thrace were rescued from the Bulgarians, and their kingdom was circumscribed by its present and proper limits along the southern banks of the Danube. The sole emperor of the Romans could no longer brook that a lord of Epirus, a Comnenian prince of the West, should presume to dispute or share the honors of the purple, and the humble Demetrius changed the color of his buskins and accepted with gratitude the appellation of despot. His own subjects were exasperated by his baseness and incapacity. They implored the protection of their supreme lord. After some resistance, the kingdom of Thessalonica was united to the empire of Nice, and Vataces reigned without a competitor from the Turkish borders to the Adriatic Gulf. The princes of Europe revered his merit and power, and had he subscribed an orthodox creed, it should seem that the Pope would have abandoned, without reluctance, the Latin throne of Constantinople. But the death of Vataces, the short and busy reign of Theodore his son, and the helpless infancy of his grandson John, suspended the restoration of the Greeks. In the next chapter I shall explain their domestic revolutions. In this place it will be sufficient to observe that the young prince was oppressed by the ambition of his guardian and colleague, Michael Palaeologus, who displayed the virtues and vices that belonged to the founder of a new dynasty. The Emperor Baldwin had flattered himself that he might recover some provinces or cities by an impotent negotiation. His ambassadors were dismissed from Nice with mockery and contempt. At every place which they named, Palaeologus alleged some special reason which rendered it dear and valuable in his eyes. In the one he was born, in another he had been first promoted to military command, and in a third he had enjoyed and hoped long to enjoy the pleasures of the chase. "And what, then, do you propose to give us?" said the astonished deputies. "Nothing," replied the Greek. "Not a foot of land. If your master be desirous of peace, let him pay me as an annual tribute the sum which he receives from the trade and customs of Constantinople. On these terms I may allow him to reign. If he refuses, it is war. I am not ignorant of the art of war, and I trust the event to God and my sword." An expedition against the despot of Epirus was the first prelude of his arms. If a victory was followed by a defeat, if the race of the Comneni or Angeli survived in those mountains, his efforts and his reign. The captivity of Villa Hardouin, prince of Achaia, deprived the Latins of the most active and powerful vassal of their expiring monarchy. The republics of Venice and Genoa disputed in the first of their naval wars the command of the sea and the commerce of the east. Pride and interest attached the Venetians to the defense of Constantinople. Their rivals were tempted to promote the designs of her enemies, and the alliance of the Genoese with the schismatic conqueror provoked the indignation of the Latin Church. Intent on his great object, the Emperor Michael visited in person and strengthened the troops and fortifications of Thrace. The remains of the Latins were driven from their last possessions. He assaulted, without success, the suburb of Galata, and corresponded with a perfidious baron who proved unwilling or unable to open the gates of the metropolis. The next spring, his favorite general, Alexius Strategopoulos, whom he had decorated with the title of Caesar, passed the Hellespont with 800 horse and some infantry on a secret expedition. His instructions enjoined him to approach, to listen, to watch, but not to risk any doubtful or dangerous enterprise against the city. The adjacent territory between the Propontis and the Black Sea was cultivated by a hardy race of peasants and outlaws, exercised in arms, uncertain in their allegiance, but inclined by language, religion, and present advantage to the party of the Greeks. They were styled the Volunteers, and by their free service the army of Alexius, with the regulars of Thrace and the Coman auxiliaries, was augmented to the number of 25,000 men. By the ardor of the Volunteers, and by his own ambition, the Caesar was stimulated to disobey the precise orders of his master, in the just confidence that the success would plead his pardon and reward. The weakness of Constantinople and the distress and terror of the Latins were familiar to the observation of the Volunteers, and they represented the present moment as the most propitious to surprise and conquest. A rash youth, the new governor of the Venetian colony, had sailed away with 30 galleys and the best of the French knights on a wild expedition to Daphnusia, a town on the Black Sea at the distance of 40 leagues. And the remaining Latins were without strength or suspicion. They were informed that Alexius had passed the Hellespont, but their apprehensions were lulled by the smallness of his original numbers, and their imprudence had not watched the subsequent increase of his army. If he left his main body to second and support his operations, he might advance unperceived in the night with a chosen detachment. While some applied scaling ladders to the lowest part of the walls, they were secure of an old Greek who would introduce their companions through a subterraneous passage into his house. They could soon, on the inside, break an entrance through the golden gate, which had been long obstructed, and the conqueror would be in the heart of the city before the Latins were conscious of their danger. After some debate, the Caesar resigned himself to the faith of the Volunteers. They were trusty, bold, and successful, and in describing the plan I have already related the execution and success. But no sooner had Alexius passed the threshold of the Golden Gate than he trembled at his own rashness. He paused, he deliberated, till the desperate Volunteers urged him forwards by the assurance that in retreat lay the greatest and most inevitable danger. Whilst the Caesar kept his regulars in firm array, The Kumans dispersed themselves on all sides. An alarm was sounded, and the threats of fire and pillage compelled the citizens to a decisive resolution. The Greeks of Constantinople remembered their native sovereigns. The Genoese merchants, their recent alliance, and Venetian foes. Every quarter was in arms, and the air resounded with a general acclamation of long life and victory to Michael and John, the august emperors of the Romans. Their rival Baldwin was awakened by the sound, but the most pressing danger could not prompt him to draw his sword in the defense of a city which he deserted, perhaps with more pleasure than regret. He fled from the palace to the seashore, where he described the welcome sails of the fleet returning from the vain and fruitless attempt on Daphnusia. Constantinople was irrecoverably lost, but the Latin emperor and the principal families embarked on board the Venetian galleys and steered for the Isle of Euboea, and afterwards for Italy, where the royal fugitive was entertained by the Pope and Sicilian king with a mixture of contempt and pity. From the loss of Constantinople to his death, he consumed 13 years, soliciting the Catholic powers to join in his restoration. The lesson had been familiar to his youth, nor was his last exile more indigent or shameful than his 3 former pilgrimages to the courts of Europe. His son Philip was the heir of an ideal empire, and the pretensions of his daughter Catherine were transported by her marriage to Charles of Valois, the brother of Philip the Fair, King of France. The House of Courtenay was represented in the female line by successive alliances till the title of Emperor of Constantinople, too bulky and sonorous for a private name, modestly expired in silence and oblivion. After this narrative of the expeditions of the Latins to Palestine and Constantinople, I cannot dismiss the subject without resolving the general consequences on the countries that were the scene and on the nations that were the actors of these memorable crusades. As soon as the arms of the Franks were withdrawn, the impression, though not the memory, was erased in the Mohammedan realms of Egypt and Syria. The faithful disciples of the prophet were never tempted by profane desire to study the laws or language of the idolaters, nor did the simplicity of their primitive manners receive the slightest alteration from their intercourse in peace and war with the unknown strangers of the West. The Greeks, who thought themselves proud, but who were only vain, showed a disposition somewhat less inflexible. In the efforts for the recovery of their empire, they emulated the valor, discipline, and tactics of their antagonists. The modern literature of the West they might justly despise, but its free spirit would instruct them in the rights of man, and some institutions of public and private life were adopted from the French. The correspondence of Constantinople and Italy diffused the knowledge of the Latin tongue, and several of the fathers and classics were at length honored with a Greek version. But the national and religious prejudices of the Orientals were inflamed by persecution, and the reign of the Latins confirmed the separation of the two churches. If we compare the era of the Crusades, the Latins of Europe with the Greeks and Arabians, their respective degrees of knowledge, industry, and art, our rude ancestors must be content with the 3rd rank in the scale of nations. Their successive improvement and present superiority may be ascribed to a peculiar energy of character, to an active and imitative spirit unknown to their more polished rivals, who at that time